Okay, I try to talk now for the next about 20 minutes, I hope, about, as you already heard, contingency of the past, possible histories, and the relation of times. And I try to go through these subjects in four steps. First of all, I speak about history in search of the definitive, then come to an eminent figure of historiography and talk a little bit about Herodotus, then switch to the latency is something I would call the unpresent, in German, das Ungegenwärtige. And finally, try to switch to a possible history of possibilities. But let's start with the big questions. History. History, what for? Why are we dealing with history? Why are we dealing with the past? Why our attention for all that once happened, and why do we revel in nostalgia? Why do we visit museums full of old stuff? Why do we celebrate jubilees extensively? Why do some of us, maybe not, but some other people at least, even reenact past battles? Why do we give history lessons, etc., etc.? If we have already come to the conclusion that all of these activities hardly help us to solve the pressing problems of today. No one has been redeemed of poverty or hunger by historical investigation, and no war has been prevented because military actions maybe were not such a good idea in the past. So why the whole thing with history, if not as a government-subsidized intellectual gimmick that one can easily afford in a capitalist welfare society? The standard answer, of course, to the question, history, what for, is as clear and as unambiguous as well established, because history helps societies to gain orientation, because history forms collective identities, and because it is necessary for the description and understanding of current conditions. Thus, if right now we do not ask the question anymore, what history could be good for, although this problem has been very prominent and widely discussed, for instance, between the 1960s and 1980s. So if we right now ask this question not anymore, this has less to do with the fact that we have found the definitive answer to it, but because the past obviously has something you cannot find in other time horizons, not in the present and not in the future. This past is characterized by the pleasant lack of contingency. It is dominated by clarity and unambiguity, because everything that has happened has happened, and there are no further alternatives. This rarely explicated, but in our cultural knowledge, deeply rooted image of the past has not been counteracted by academic historians. In fact, it often has been promoted by them by forces. Because historiography has great difficulties with all forms of possibility, regardless if these possibilities come along as contingency, latency, potency, we heard about that already. The difficulties of historiography with the category of possibility can be found in two respects at least. First, the general understanding of what is commonly called history in Western cultures can be defined as the field of the actual past events, not of possible past events. And second, until this very day, historiography sees it as one of its essential features to give true descriptions of these actual past events. And this self-understanding is an important basis for history as an academic discipline, namely to deal with real and not with imagined pasts, and facts. In contrast, for example, to literary analysis, history sees it as one of its core features that it has a real and a non-textual reference. It refers to the past. And in this context, the category of the possible plays a role that cannot even be described as marginal. Now, this problem of clarity and ambiguity, of actuality and potency, or in almost dramatic dimensions, if you like, of truth and falsehood, are tracking history since its very beginnings. And I will try to grab this question at its roots, maybe, and try to elaborate on it a little bit with the help of the so-called Pater Historiae, the father of history, Herodotus. Where else but in Herodotus should we obtain confirmation as to what historiography wants, how its problems are designed, and what we even have to think about this whole mess? The problems are there already, even before we start reading the histories of Herodotus, because we know already, even before we open the book, in advance, that he is the so-called father of history. And thus, we are ahead of Herodotus himself, because he had no idea about that fact or that title or his fatherhood. For reasons of logics, one can only be the first historian when a second comes after you. So this tradition really only began with Thucydides, whose historiographical writing made Herodotus what he is for us now, but never intended to be. But not only in terms of logic, also in terms of a critical genealogy, one must be skeptical when Herodotus is called the father of history, because that assigns him a certain role in retrospect that he cannot fulfill. As soon as Herodotus is attributed with this paternal role, along with its scientific, philosophical, and moral implications, we can wonder afterwards why he is not fulfilling it. And we can lead strange discussions afterwards about the relations of truth and falsehood in the writings of Herodotus. Thus, is he actually, that's one of the main questions in the historiographical discussions, is he actually the first historian, or is he the first historical liar? Because of all the funny stories he's telling. Already the contemporaries of Herodotus have discussed that issue, and we do so still at the beginning of the 21st century. There are certainly good reasons to understand Herodotus as an unreliable storyteller. For instance, when he reports about giant ants from India digging for gold, or when he's talking about the poet Arion riding on a dolphin through the sea, or about another poet called Aristeas, whose soul was able to leave his body and return into it, or about a field of bones of flying snakes in Arabia, and so on and so forth. You find dozens and even hundreds of these stories in Herodotus. The entire reception of the histories of Herodotus from antiquity until today is marked by this problem and by this conflict. After 2.5 millennia of reception of Herodotus, we have probably come to the conclusion that we will never be able to say substantially which of Herodotus's information corresponds to the so-called facts and which do not. What is a lie and what is true? However, whose problem is that? If we want to commit Herodotus to the definitive of a historiography that we only have attributed to him afterwards, then that not only produces certain problems, problems he himself might not have had, but also makes it difficult to identify the moment of latency included in the work of Herodotus. Because Herodotus does not follow the path of an unambiguity. He rather presents different versions and diverse possibilities to one and the same story at the same time. And he is doing so systematically throughout his whole work. There have been counted more than 125 passages in the histories where Herodotus delivers more than one, sometimes three or four versions of the same event or of a certain development. And he also provides a justification for this approach. In book 7 of the histories, he says, I quote, "But I am held to report what is reported, but to believe everything I am not maintained. And this word is to apply for my whole presentation," end of quote. Just like Columbus never intended to discover America, Herodotus never intended to found historiography. With all the rear projections, all the anachronisms, all the theological interpretations, mythical thought structures, biographical constrictions, and also obvious inventions, the histories of Herodotus rather seem to be explorations in the space of the possible. Soundings in the real, in the realm of the unseen, in order to discover as many of the latent tracks as possible that have created the one event Herodotus is really interested in, namely the struggle of the Greeks against the Persian supremacy. That is the thing he's interested in. And see, in this way, historiography wins something that after Herodotus has been tried to exercise from the historical field with many efforts. Not to understand history as something definite and conclusive, not as something characterized by a lack of contingency, but as a space of possibilities and as a stronghold of latency. And what Herodotus offers is not just the decidedness of a historical truth, but that does not make him a liar. Herodotus leaves a space of possibility to the past. I think that's quite an important point, for me, at least. Now, Herodotus treats plurality not only on the object side, not because he describes certain versions of the same event, and not only in his ethnographic descriptions of the Lydians, the Egyptians, the Persians, and so on, but also on the methodological side. The possibilities to explain the improbable occurrence of a specific event are not just given in the simultaneity of the here and now, but exist also in the latency of the past. For Herodotus, the historical event, in this case, the victory of the Greeks over the Persians, is only the apparent and the obvious side of what was hidden for years, for decades, and even for centuries. The event unfolds certain areas of the latently existent, reveals, if you like, certain historical possibilities which were implicit until then. And if we speak about the relations between latency and time, or a little bit more precisely maybe, about the relations between latency and history, then the essential fact must be borne in mind that latency always only becomes visible in the aftermath. Latency is always what I would call unpresent, ungegenwärtig. It's not present, it's unpresent. It is there, but it's not observable. It is existing, but not available. And this applies, for example, for those areas in medicine, engineering, or economics, working with different forms of a latency period. For instance, the extension between a nerve stimulus and a neural response can only be determined afterwards. However, this applies equally to the latency as a historical category. For instance, when we describe historical epochs, which happens typically afterwards. Therefore, I think it is helpful to use the implicit as a synonym for this latency. For here in the implicit, something is wrapped in, is folded in, deriving from this Latin plicare. Something is folded in, something is there indeed the whole time, but not present. In historical perspective, one has found the expression of an iceberg of history for this phenomenon. Of this iceberg, as you all know, only a small part floats on the surface of the obvious, while the rest remains hidden underneath and exists as a virtual or a latent history. And this sub-aquatic area can develop into an entire complex, or into an implex, a word I learned from Paul Valéry. Paul Valéry once called this complex implicit the implex. And Valéry wanted this implex to be understood as a cosmos existing in humans and being able to surprise people with ideas, with feelings, with works, etc., of which they previously had no idea. That's the implex. And this implex contains, as Valéry said, I quote, possible variations of the possible. Possible variations of the possible. But these variations are not only to be discovered inside human beings. but also in time and especially in the past. These possible variations of the possible are not just part of what may come in the future, but also part of that which was already in the past without having realized itself. The implex stores the unrealized past futures waiting for their explication and for their unfolding. However, it is not that easy to transfer this area of possibilities into the past, thus into the time horizon of which we are inclined to think that it lacks contingency. To make the latency and the implex productive for the past, it is necessary to gain a different perspective on time. Then it is not enough to look at the latency in time, but then I think we need a special attention for the latency of time. Thus, if latency is unpresent in the sense I mentioned before, one could say latency is here, but not now. Latency share with us contemporaneity, but not the actuality. Thus, if latency is unpresent in this sense, then latency is described as a place for interrelating the times. And the observation and description of latency thus comes along with the ability to handle the coexistence and mutual infection of these times. So let's try to take Herodotus' paternity of historiography seriously, namely, before this background of the implicit and the latent in the past. Then, history would not only provide the facts, and the verified would not only present things that are withdrawn from contingency, but would also show us the available possibilities. Then we should ask the question, how a possible history of the possible could possibly look like? This question is much more than an intellectual game. As Petra Gehring has argued, reality escapes through intangibility as soon as you try to nail it down. Contrary to the supposedly clear logic of a truth model, reality escapes by forms of doubt, forms of suspicion or falsehood. And as Gehring said, if you try to speak the truth about the world will kick back and adopt the mode of possibilities. It is worth to look at these possible forms more closely, especially with regard to the potency that existed in the past, but still is latently present and can be reactualized. But what should that be? How could there be contingent pasts? Certainly not in the sense that what has happened could not have happened at the same time. If you follow Giorgio Agamben, Vittoria mentioned already, contingency has the ability to give back the past, to give back to the past the potency also not to be. And I do not want to strain Herodotus in this context too much, but his descriptions of a historical event wins. It's appeal precisely because they are not presented primarily as necessary. He presents them not as necessary, but as not impossible. Events are not necessary, they are not impossible. Thus, variations are conceivable how an event could not have been. And in this way, the contingency of the past and the resulting possibilities become visible. This contingency shows itself, for example, in a memory that can modify the facts of the past, and especially remembering is one way to give back the past its potency. In memory, you can undo what has happened, and things can be done that never have happened. It is the memory of what was not, and the forgetting of what was. Such an approach to the past and its potency is, of course, not restricted to forms of memory, but is significant for any reference of a present to a certain past. It is almost inevitable in this interrelation of different times to highlight certain aspects and to emphasize things that had not happened so far, for instance, because they have not been considered as worth a history, and to let other aspects fall into oblivion because they are considered historically as not relevant. To make the contingency and the latency visible, especially with regard to the past, has a significant effect. Thereby, time gets out of joint. At least the dominant concept of time gets out of joint, which we understand as a singular and homogeneous flow running through all our lives and being something of a temporal replacement of God. And like Hamlet, and together with Jacques Derrida, we can see that it is precisely this broken up time, this time that is not in joint anymore, which opens up a space of contingency and of possibility. At the very moment when the idea of a homogeneous and a grotted time breaks up, the mechanisms become visible, how past and present are linked in certain cultural relations, and ways become obvious how to create these relations between the times in new ways. I would like to call these relations between times chronoferences. Three aspects can characterize a chronoference briefly. The first is the lifting of the dichotomous opposition between past and present, to show instead that and how a present is connected and intertwined with different absent times, namely past and future. Secondly, chronoference highlights the media, the material leftovers from the past that are reactualized again and again in a given present. And thirdly, it is about historiography as a present-day practice, not just because historiography asks questions of current interests, but mostly because it works in a presence on the time frame which distinguishes between past and future. And such chronoferences make it possible, for instance, that dinosaurs are extinct and very present creatures at the same time. With such chronoferences, therefore, more and different claims are articulated than the referring of a presence to of a present to a past in any manner. Because chronoferences are always accompanied by a pluralization of temporal possibilities. Discussing the relations between past and present can therefore be an experimental field of historiographical practice, in that they create different spaces of possibility. Virtualities, potentialities, contingencies, and even impossibilities can be treated there and can be used as challenges to entrenched beliefs. The reproduction of relation between past and present is thus a turn against unilinear historical ideas. But the chronoferences are not solely constructed by a present. Rather, we have to recognize the potential of unlived or untapped realities which the past holds for us. The past holds a huge arsenal of unrealized reality. To be present and to live currently always means to live with a still unlived but latently existing past. And with Robert Musil, we therefore can say that realities prove to be only the shrinkage stages of all the possible worlds. As you know, Ulrich, Musil's Man Without Qualities, for Ulrich, the sense of the possible is essential to deal with the world. Ulrich imagines, for instance, God after creating the world, looking at it and thinking, well, it could as well have been different. So the sense of possibility, to quote Musil, the sense of possibility could almost be defined as the ability to imagine anything that might be just as well, and to take all that is not as more important than all that is not, end of quote. Musil's plea for the sense of possibility leads us to track something we could call a symmetrical historiography, and this would endeavor not only to represent the successful developments, but also the much more numerous dead ends, the wrong turns, and the unsuccessful ways. And this way, historiography could provide us with the potentiality that we require of it, by showing that it always could have been different, like Musil's God said. Forgotten history would not be the extinguished but the virtual part of the past, just waiting to be brought back to the surface, which is with its untapped potency. And this would then also show that the past is just as unpredictable as the future, because we do not know today what might interest us tomorrow about yesterday. Thank you.